Thanks, Brother Lee, and good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters. At our last class, we saw that David had been prompted by the promises that had been given to him to secure his borders. Because of what God had told him, he immediately moved to try and bring peace and to remove the enemies so that his people were at rest, finally, because he knew that that was a prerequisite for the house of God to be built. And although God had said, "You're not going to build it, David," that did not stop him going ahead and trying to secure the borders right out to the Abrahamic boundaries almost in order for that to happen. Now, if you just come to chapter 8 and verse 10, there, let's just pick this up again and partway through that verse after Toi had sent Joram down to see King David and to say we want to be friends, we want to be allies. And Joram, halfway through that verse, Joram brought with him vessels of silver and vessels of gold and vessels of brass, which also King David did dedicate unto Yahweh, with the silver and the gold that he had dedicated of all nations which he subdued, out of Syria, Moab, and so there's a great long list, and all the spoil that came from various other of the battles that that David had actually fought. You know, the law actually gave license to take the spoil from nations that were not immediately in the land. If they were not of the Amorites, they were to burn everything of the Amorites that were actually in the land when they came in under Joshua. They were told explicitly about that. But Deuteronomy 20 said, you can take the spoil to yourself. And, we don't know how much the people got of this. And we'll come back to this little idea later. But we don't know how much the people got. They evidently got some of the effects of the spoil, but most of the gold and the silver and the brass and so on was taken and put by David into the coffers of the empire, really, as it was becoming at that stage. And that gives us a bit of an insight into David's mind. You know, the reason that he actually made a move out here was to bring peace. I don't think there's any question about that. But as he goes, right from the start, he's stockpiling all the gold, silver and the precious things and putting them aside. So clearly in his mind, this movement against these enemies around had another purpose, that is to prepare for that house being built. You can see where David's mind is. I mean, we know that of David. David was a man that just soared above. He saw beyond what most people around him saw. And here his mind is just going right beyond where the people are to the time when a house would finally be built, even though he was told he was not allowed to do it. You know, and David, where did he actually get that idea from? And, you just cast your mind back. Where did the first tabernacle come from? Where did the gold and the silver and all the precious things for the building of the first house actually come from? Well, it was the spoiling of the Gentiles. It was Egypt's gold and silver that they spoiled before they left Egypt. And they took it and then donated it to the building of the first tabernacle. And here's the second tabernacle. Here's the second temple in prospect about to be built. And David's already taken a precedent from that day and he's using the nations around in order to gather his wealth so that he can actually do something with it. And we know that the future temple is going to be built on the same premise, on the same foundation. That when that day comes and Christ is about to establish the temple in Jerusalem, it will be from the wealth of the nations. I mean, if you want to make a note, we won't turn it up at the moment, but in Isaiah chapter 60, perhaps I'll just read you one verse from there. Isaiah chapter 60 says, "The wealth of the Gentiles shall come in unto Israel." And it goes on to say, "And the glory of Lebanon shall come to them, and the fir tree and the pine tree and the box, and to beautify the place of my sanctuary." So that the wealth and all that's coming from the nations is going to flow in a future age, just like David actually gathered these precious things. So David had brought peace to the north, south, east and west. You know, I mean, there's a list of the seven military campaigns. And, you know, I used to think I suppose that they were really seriously considering it. That yes, there were seven military campaigns, and it lines up with the seven thunders of Revelation and the judgments that are yet to come, with the march of the rainbowed angel. But I never really seriously had thought about just what David was doing. I have no doubt that David did not plan seven military campaigns. David had no intent to fight seven military campaigns. I think it's reasonably certain that David had an intent to fight some of those. And the first four, I think David actually planned to fight. And the others, he didn't. And certainly it makes seven, even though there were not seven separate nations, there were only six. But David, I believe, actually only planned four of those. And what he did is he attacked to the west, to the east, to the north and the south. And he secured all the borders all around. And he pushed the boundaries out to Abrahamic limits almost. That was planned. I have no doubt that was planned. And that's why the record of 2 Samuel 8 then tells us where we start tonight, when we started reading tonight, which is just after he's finally defeated Edom in the south. It says, "And David reigned over all Israel and executed judgment and justice unto his people." Have you ever thought that, why is that right there? Why didn't it tell us that either at the start or at the end? Why in the middle? Well, I think it's fairly clear that David actually had done what he intended to do. And now the divine historian tells us the kingdom was being consolidated. You know, the kingdom was actually very, very different now at this point than it was when David first came into power as king. You remember the Philistines had infiltrated right in. They'd taken Israel's towns. They'd even penetrated, did you know, across the Jordan, from their territory across the Jordan. So they'd almost cut Israel in two. And the other enemies had control of the borders and had encroached. So we're now in a very different state. The borders are way extended past where they are. But now the kingdom is very complex. Initially, David had just the kingdom of Judah to look after, reigning over one tribe, essentially, and perhaps some of Benjamin. But really, it was really only over Judah to begin with. But now he's reigning over a kingdom that has the combined 12 tribes united. That's one part of his jurisdiction. He has kings that have been totally conquered, and now he's taken their lands and expanded his empire. So he's now got to actually administer all of those areas, quite substantial tracts of territory that he'd taken. And on top of that, he's now got a third thing. He's got vassal kings in other territories that are now subservient, but still in their own lands and paying huge amounts of tribute down to Jerusalem. And that would have taken a massive amount of organisation. And what we're being told here is, it tells us in verse 15 of 2 Samuel 8, this is now just a very brief snapshot summary of David as finally the kingdom is getting to its zenith. And I don't doubt for a moment, brothers and sisters, this is the zenith of David's kingdom. He had pushed out the borders to their furthest extent. The people were united. The country was wealthy. God was in the centre of the worship. The worship had been established and it was valued by the people. The enemies were subdued on all the borders, and the people now had peace and rest. Everything was organised as only David probably could have done, perhaps Solomon his son as well. But David had an amazing mind when he turned it to the benefit of his people. And so everything was going well. And the tribute as it came in was then being fed back in for the benefit of the nation itself. And so the divine historian in one verse just says, he reigned over all Israel and executed judgment and justice unto his people. And we could so easily just read across those that sentence, brothers and sisters. What an amazing wealth of information is hidden, just locked up in that little verse. You know, God had called, or had sought out, Samuel was told, a man after his own heart. A man who would do his will, who would not be stiff-necked like Saul. But you know, when David is called a man after God's own heart, it's said in reference to him ruling over God's people. Because God was seeking a man who would care not only about what God had revealed, that's what he was seeking first, but he was seeking a man who would care for his people as God himself would care. Just listen to these words. You've heard them lots of times. You probably know where they come from. Psalm 78, verse 70. He chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the ewes great with young, he brought him to feed Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. And so he fed them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with the skillfulness of his hands. And God had specifically chosen this man in the end to guide and rule and direct and inspire his people. He had not chosen David to be a mighty warrior, though David was a mighty warrior and goes down as a man of blood. That's not what God chose him for. God chose him to rule over his people with justice and judgment. And in that Psalm 78, particularly verse 72, it tells us about the integrity of his heart and the skillfulness of his hands, which is really talking about the care that he had for those that he loved. And so we've got the very qualities that God was looking for in this man. And David just wasn't a brilliant soldier and a very smart and astute general. He wasn't just a leader of men, though he was all of those things. He was first a man of God, first a man who'd been touched by the word of God in his heart and whose concern therefore went out to the weary and the lonely and the forsaken and the poor, to all his jurisdiction. And that is what this man brought to the throne when it was finally established. So this record that's telling us in verse 15 of 2 Samuel 8 that David reigned over all Israel is not just saying, oh, well, you know, he's finally king because he'd been king for some time. This is telling us something about the quality of his kingship. You know, the message that came to from the angel to Mary, proclaiming that Christ was going to be born, Jesus was going to be born, and she was going to be the mother. The angel said, "And the Lord God will give unto him this baby that was to be born the throne of his father David." Now, I think because we've read those words so many times, we just miss really what's being said. The throne of his father David. What was the throne of his father? What did the throne of David mean? Well, I think this verse tells us here in Samuel, 2 Samuel 8 verse 15 tells us what the throne of David was, because here we're told explicitly by the divine penman that David reigned over Israel and he executed judgment and justice unto all his people. The word for judgment is the There's the normal word that's used for judgment, just the Hebrew word mishpat. I don't really know what the word mishpat. I think the word judgment often has the wrong connotation to us. Because the word mishpat in the Hebrew, as it's translated judgment, it's not always translated judgment, by the way, doesn't just mean, you know, big fire and brimstone from here. It doesn't mean that. In most cases, it doesn't mean that in the scriptures. It just means to discern right, to make fair and absolutely right decisions, it's about decision making. And because God makes the right decisions and some people are on the wrong side, they might cop the fire and brimstone. But judgment, the judgment of God, can easily cut exactly the same way and be have its outcome and its working in something that's ultimately positive and very upbuilding for people. So judgment is really about, and where David here is executing judgment, it means just fair and always right decisions and righteousness. Well, it says here, justice. And I don't know whether you're aware of this, but in the Old Testament, especially in the Authorized Version, the Hebrew word for righteousness is translated a number of different ways, and one of them is justice, and it's sometimes translated righteousness. In fact, even in the same context sometimes, only a couple of verses apart in the prophets, it's actually translated differently, and it sort of obscures it to us, but it's actually the same word in the Hebrew. So this really is saying judgment and righteousness rather than justice. It is actually the normal word for righteousness, talking about absolutely integrity and uprightness, and righteousness is fixed by God himself. So here's David that's prepared to make right decisions all the time, and they're based absolutely on the righteousness of God, and that is the foundation of his kingdom. He's extended the borders and all that, those kinds of things, but the divine penman says, now the real thing that you will need to know about this amazing kingdom you're seeing, is that it's founded on these two principles. And they're seen in that king. He will make the right decisions in absolute integrity, and they'll be right every time because he believes so implicitly that what God says is absolutely right. And notice it says, to all his people. He executed this unto all his people. And how amazingly unusual that was in Eastern kingdoms. Usually Eastern monarchies were characterized by tyranny and injustice and oppression of the worst kind, cruelty, and monarchs were seen to be partial and open to corruption, self-seeking the whole time. And their people would go and stuff. It's just like a lot of the dictators that we've seen, even in our own day. These crazy men who build up immense fortunes for themselves, and their people starve. They couldn't care about any of their people. They're only interested in power and where it's going. They'll make decisions based on what's expedient for them right now and what's going to get them furthest and or more in their pocket. And almost every kingdom around David was like that. And David had never had a decent role model. There'd only ever been one king in Israel before. And every other kingdom he looked to would have given him the wrong impression. So his leadership, his kingship here, was based absolutely and squarely on what he knew of the throne of Yahweh. So he had to invent for the very first time what a kingdom really should look like. How a king should reign was David's to forge, because Saul was certainly not a good king and had not always reigned in justice and righteousness. Look what happened to David himself under Saul's rule, let alone other people who must have felt the same sort of whims in the man Saul as well. Well, I don't know if you know that this term, the throne of Yahweh, isn't used very many times. And it first appears when talking about David and David passing that throne to Solomon, and it's never used again. That is, of all in the rest of the kingdom. Because I think we got to this point in David's reign where David had established typically what the rule of Christ was going to be like. He had actually got so close to what Christ's whole attitude of mind and basis for his kingdom was. And it really never ever returned to that throughout the rest of the time of the kingdom. You know, we know exactly what David thought about the kingdom. Even though it says for us only in one verse that David executed judgment and justice unto all his people. And notice it says all his people, not just some, not just those who had money, not just those who had influence, to all. I need to underline that word. It's probably one of the most important words in that verse because it tells us something about David's mind. He had actually understood that God is good unto all, and he was determined to copy it. Come to Psalm 72, because this is an amazing psalm that we could just about recite and we'll sing in our last hymn. But Psalm 72, brothers and sisters, is an insight into David's mind when it comes to what the kingdom was about. Because we know in verse 20 it says, the prayers of David the son of Jesse are ended. This is David's personal vision of a kingdom. And it says at the start that it's a psalm for Solomon. And it's no doubt that's probably what it was written for, to pass to Solomon as advice from David. But it's David's mind on this. And while it's inspired, it still came from him. This is the way this man actually thought. Look how it starts. Give the king thy judgment, O God, and thy righteousness unto the king's son. He shall judge thy people with righteousness and thy poor with judgment. The first two verses, brothers and sisters, twice mention those two qualities that the divine penman in 2 Samuel 8 had picked up as the characteristics of David's reign. So here's David telling him, this was not an accident that happened back there. This was David's mind. David here is asking for the king to be given God's judgments and his righteousness. And that he saw was the most fundamental foundation upon which the kingdom should rest. You know, brothers and sisters, this is an amazingly messianic psalm. It is going to form the basis of Christ's kingdom. And when Jesus comes, brothers and sisters, what he's going to do in this world is bring the judgments of God. Now, it's true, there will be destruction. But that's actually not really what the judgments of God are about. There will be a necessity for some of that. But Christ will come in God's behalf and establish the right decisions on everything. And the very, very first thing that Christ is going to do is to take the judgments of God, the decisions that God makes on things, and based on God's righteousness, and is going to apply that. That is the first thing that he's going to do. And this psalm tells us that. And you know what? It's not just this psalm as well. Just hold your hand there. How many hands you got? You got one in Samuel. You got one in Psalms. You got another one? Come to Isaiah 32. Just for a minute. This is just one other example, but there are lots of these. Isaiah 32 verse 1. This is typical of what the prophets actually tell us in relation to the kingdom and when Christ comes. Behold, a king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment. And a man shall be as a hiding place in the wind, and so on. Goes on to give a description of what is going to happen and how the saints are going to be involved. But it starts there by telling us that a king is going to reign in righteousness and rule in judgment. Here's the foundation. And then Isaiah tells us a little later on in that chapter, verse 16. And then, after all this has been happening, then judgment, right decisions, are going to dwell in the wilderness of the people. And righteousness will remain in the fruitful field. Unlike now, and the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. And my people shall dwell in peaceable habitation, and sure dwellings, and quiet. quiet resting place. You know, brothers and sisters, Christ is not coming to bring peace just magically. He will come with righteousness and judgment. And when finally those principles have settled into the minds of individuals and the world has learned what that means and the value of it, there will flow from that a peace like this world has never, ever seen. And there will be quietness and assurance forever. You know, David actually understood that principle, and what he did, though he had to fight some battles to start with and establish that these people had taken unlawfully the land that had been given to the fathers of old, David, by establishing his own kingdom in righteousness and justice, and had laid the foundation for a peace that lasted through his life as far as the nations around are concerned, and therefore established a model for what Christ is going to do in the future. And so it's going to be Christ's first priority. It's no doubt that that's why we find in 2 Samuel 8 and in Psalm 72 that this is actually labour. Just come back to Psalm 72 for a minute. Because the problems that our world faces are, you know, things like oppression and violence and corruption and evil of all kinds. Harken back to the lack of righteousness and the lack of judgment in the lives of individuals. Lack of appreciation, ignorance in many cases, but willful ignorance in the case of some. And that will hence be Christ's first priority in establishing, trying to establish a world that will be brought to peace finally. But, you know, there's not all harshness about judgment. Look at Psalm, because this is the mind of David here. Verse 4, "And he shall judge." It's the same word from which judgment comes. "He shall judge the poor of the people. He'll discern right on their behalf. And he shall save the children of the needy. And he shall break in pieces the oppressor." You see, the judgment and discernment of right and wrong is actually going to lead to saving of the oppressed and the breaking of the oppressor. That is what Christ is going to do. You think about our world. You think about how many millions and millions of people are in the case, in the situation of being the poor and the oppressed by the very few oppressors. There are millions upon millions. There are probably billions of people in our world that will be relieved by that judgment when he comes to make right and discerning judgments. Verse 7, "And his days the righteous shall flourish, and abundance of peace will flow from that." Verse 12, "For he shall deliver the needy when he crieth, and the poor also, and him that hath no helper. He shall spare the poor and the needy, and shall save the souls of the needy. He shall redeem their soul from deceit and violence." Because he's first established the right principles, and it's where David's kingdom went. And David knew that this is actually how you had to run a kingdom. It's his own personal vision here. So he's going to be like rain that came down upon the mown grass. And I have no doubt that in David's time, the people saw David just like that. They saw David as a king, a leader out front, that was just so refreshing, so life-giving, so amazing in his example and his spiritual mind and his leadership of the whole of the nation, that they just were so thankful that God had provided such a man. And righteous did flourish in his days. And verse 8, "He shall have dominion from sea to sea, from the river to the end of the earth." That's what David did for his people. He gave them that dominion. He pushed the nations out. And enemies, verse 9, "The enemies shall lick the dust as they had done in those earlier campaigns. And kings," verse 11, "shall fall down before him, and all nations shall serve him." Of course, David, under the inspiration, is looking forward to the future as well. He's speaking about how he saw his own kingdom here. And verse 17, "And his name shall endure forever. His name shall continue as long as the sun, and all men shall call him blessed." Well, certainly they did in his day. And locked in that one verse in 2 Samuel 8 is a whole wealth that's expanded in David's mind in Psalm 72. It's actually a good thing to write Psalm 72 alongside verse 15 because I think it just opens it out and tells us about it. But you know, that's not even the whole story. There's another piece of the jigsaw here. The record of David's wars seem to be interrupted. I actually thought they were interrupted. I don't now think that. I actually think David's campaigns that he had intended had finished. But be that as it may, there are more wars coming in chapter 10 and 11 and 12. And even some even further on than that. But then at this point, suddenly, in chapter 9, bursts onto the scene and we find that verse 1 says, David said, "Is there yet any left of the house of Saul that I might show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" And we know, and we'll have a look at this in more in just a minute, that word kindness is repeated down in verse 3 and in verse 7 as well, three times. David's saying he wants to show kindness to Saul's house. And the word kindness there is the Hebrew word chesed, which is sometimes translated mercy, sometimes loving kindness in some translations. It is a quality of God. It's the only quality in Exodus 34 that's mentioned twice about God. And you know, brothers and sisters, when you think about this, this is occurring just right here. We've been told that David's reigning in justice and judgment as a king. And then immediately we're told something about David showing kindness, showing the love and mercy of God to someone. So here's a picture that's blending Psalm 72 together, because Psalm 72 started with the justice and righteousness of God being the foundation, but ended up further as that was being established in the king showing mercy to the poor, and the kindness that he showed out to those that were unable to help themselves is right through Psalm 72. So here's another piece of this jigsaw that's actually appearing straight after the declaration that the kingdom has been established here. And it completes the picture of David in his kingdom. And it shows that truly this is a magnificent type of our Lord Jesus Christ's reign. Just come to Jeremiah chapter 9 for a minute. And I'm sure you're familiar with these words, perhaps in a different context, but in Jeremiah chapter 9, God says here, through the prophet, verse 24, "But let him that glorieth," if anyone's going to boast anything, let them glory in this, "that he understands and knows me, that I am Yahweh which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight." So God himself, coming through the prophet, said, if you want to know what it means to know me truly, if you want to know what it's like for me to be in harmony absolutely with somebody, well, you learn that I am a God that doesn't just talk about things, but that I exercise three qualities. And they are chesed, which is that word for loving kindness, judgment, which is mishpat, that we saw of David, and righteousness, which again is that same word that occurred back there, both in Psalm 72 and in 2 Samuel 8. So here we've got, brothers and sisters, the character of God encapsulated in three qualities. Exercising, that is actively involved in judgment, righteousness, and showing loving kindness. And it's exercising all those things. Now, why that's an interesting thing is because we've just been told that the kingdom was established and David was reigning with justice and judgment. And immediately following that, he's exercising those two things, we're told. And immediately following that in chapter 9, we're told that he is absolutely going for all his worth to find someone to exercise the kindness of God, the chesed of Yahweh, to someone else that was really undeserving in his own right of those things. And so we've got there a man truly after God's own heart. No wonder the people actually loved David, and no wonder his kingdom prospered under his hand. And it wasn't because of his intellectual brilliance. It was because of his total and absolute affinity with his God. And what a powerful lesson that is for us, brothers and sisters. It doesn't matter how intelligent or what strengths or skills we have. If we can come to exercise the judgment, the righteousness, and the loving kindness of God, and learn from this man too, all manner of things will fix themselves in our lives and in the lives of those around us, as David himself found. I'd like to come over to Isaiah chapter 16, because here's a beautiful little verse tucked in this somewhat obscure context, but that gives us a picture of what Christ's kingdom is going to be like. Verse 5 of Isaiah 16. And in mercy shall the throne be established. It's chesed. In chesed shall the throne be established. Now, that's a very strange thing to say, because generally the throne wasn't established in mercy. But the throne of Christ is going to be established. It's going to be prepared through mercy. And he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment. There's our word mishpat. And hasting righteousness. So here's a picture of Christ's kingdom. And it pulls all of them together. Having been prepared in mercy, God, the great king, will sit on his throne, seeking judgment and hasting righteousness and extending mercy to all his people. Well, the structure of David's administration, just coming back to 2 Samuel 8, we're not going to spend any time on this really. I would like at some later stage, and it might be a long way away, I hope our Lord's here by then, but there is more details about David's administration locked up in the latter part of Chronicles, and we find a lot of information about some of these individuals that are recorded here. But to summarise, the last few verses of chapter 8 are really telling us about the key people in David's administration. And he had two people that were over the military and the security, and they did lots of other jobs and stuff around the country as well when it wasn't in wartime. That was Joab, the captain of the host, and Benaiah, who was a Levite. In fact, he was from a priestly family. And he was over the Pelethites and the Kelethites, which I don't want to go into right now, but suffice it to say that I think that they were David's bodyguard and David's intelligence service. And Benaiah was one of the most trusted people in the kingdom, because he was he had the security of the king on his hands. And there were two civilian administrators in here. Jehoshaphat, who's it says was the recorder, the remembrancer, he may have been somewhat like a secretary of state, recorded events and organized all manner of things. We also have Seraiah, the scribe, who is probably the historian, because that was an important part of the king. What other functions he had, we don't know. And then there were two religious rulers there, Zadok and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, or vice versa, as many people think. And then there were David had his sons as chief rulers. Now, clearly they are younger, quite a bit younger here, although I must admit that some of these must not have been too old, because we find that some of them went into Solomon's reign, as well at the end. But it was a remarkable team in his cabinet that had expanded the administration out to all these new lands and established the people and had the nation ticking. And we know that there were systems of for the priests and the Levites. There were systems set up in place for the military that we read about later. But let's just come to chapter 9 now for a moment, because this I suppose to me it's always seemed to be a bit of an anachronism, sort of out of place chronologically or just in the middle of David's campaigns or whatever. And perhaps one of the reasons why it's placed here is because it actually is an illustration of the full picture of David's qualities and character as a king. And hence it's put there at the time when the kingdom has finally been pushed out to its furthest extent. And this is telling us about the character of the king. I've no doubt that that is certainly part of it. But I think there's more than that. Because he had secured his borders with these campaigns. Then this thing just drops in here. David asks, you know, is there yet left any of the house of Saul that I might show kindness for Jonathan's sake? You think, well, he's been king for quite some time. How come he hadn't looked for anyone from Jonathan's line or from Saul's household up until now? Why start sort of suddenly looking for this now? Just seems strange that David hadn't known of any of Jonathan's relatives. But when you actually think about it, he may actually have searched earlier considerably. But we do know this, that Mephibosheth was 5 when David was 30. We know that absolutely because Mephibosheth was 5 when Jonathan was killed. And we know David became king immediately after that, and he was 30 when he became king. So there's a 25-year age gap between these two, David and Mephibosheth. Now, David had not been in the court of Saul for at least 6 years before Jonathan's death. That means David wouldn't have known that Mephibosheth had even been born. He hadn't been in contact. We know nothing about any contact with Jonathan and David in those last 6 years. So David may not have even known that Jonathan had a son. And it seems that there were no other sons earlier than that. And it's quite reasonable for David to assume that David actually was thinking there was no son of Jonathan. There was none of Jonathan's children that he could show kindness to. And Jonathan was killed along with all his brothers, apart from Ish-bosheth. And then Ish-bosheth was killed later. So all of Saul's sons had gone as well. So what was David to do? And did you notice it didn't say, is there any left of the house of Jonathan? Because I don't think David thought there was anyone left in the house of Jonathan. Yeah, I think thought the house of Jonathan's finished. But he goes back a stage to the house of Saul, which is even more significant. Because now he's looking for somebody who, in Saul's line, whom he might show the kindness. Well, if you look at the precedents around the place, and David didn't have any precedents, right? He was the first changeover king in Israel. But in every other kingdom in the Middle Eastern area, what would happen as a ruler took over a different dynasty, they would almost certainly kill every single member of the previous dynasty's family. It was common knowledge and common practice that if a new dynasty was set up, they would just entirely obliterate the previous. You know, that practice even started happening, didn't it, in Israel's history with Athaliah and so on. So if with that in mind, and with Saul's house and the sort of thing that they'd been told about by Abner and so on, you can imagine that anyone left in Saul's house may have been absolutely terrified of meeting the sword at the hand of David. And they were terrified of his reputation as well. So if you were in Saul's house, given all that background, you would have been 1,000 miles away from anywhere that David was. You wouldn't have been going seeking David. But here, David comes in wanting to show kindness for Jonathan's sake. They want him to show chesed 3 times in that chapter. You need to underline them or colour them in. Now, Jonathan made 3 covenants with David. I'm not going to go through all these tonight, but if you want to make a note of them, the succinct parts of the covenant are in 1 Samuel 18, verse 3, in chapter 20, verse 16, and 23, verse 18. And we're all aware of the amazing friendship that David had with Jonathan. It was largely initially driven by Jonathan, who was the older of the two. But it's the second covenant that's really significant here. And let's just go to 2 Samuel 20, just for a minute. 1 Samuel 20, which is the second of these covenants that Jonathan and David made. Jonathan made with David. It's definitely on Jonathan making this covenant. And we go back to verse 12, and it says, "And Jonathan said unto David, O Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, when I have sounded my father about tomorrow, any time, or the third day, and behold, if it be good towards David, and I then send not unto thee and show it thee, Yahweh, do so much more to Jonathan. But if it please my father to do the evil, then I'll show it thee and send thee away, that thou mayest go in peace, and Yahweh be with thee as he hath been with my father. And thou shalt not only, while I yet live, show me kindness, the kindness of Yahweh, the chesed of Yahweh, that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off the kindness from my house." Now, like, I'd have a look at this up here, because I think the RSV actually repunctuates this, and so does a number of other translations. And I think it really gets the sense of it much better. And you've got this chesed of Yahweh in there twice, and it's highlighted here as loyal love and loyalty in the RSV. And it says, he says, "If I am still alive," this is Jonathan speaking, "if I'm still alive, show me the loyal love of Yahweh that I may die not." Now, that's saying, really, in essence, Jonathan's saying, assure me that you're going to show me the love of Yahweh, and that you're not going to allow me to be killed as a result of our relationship, our covenant together, and our friendship. And then he goes on to say, "And do not cut off your loyalty from my house forever." And when Yahweh cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth, let not the name of Jonathan be cut off from the house of David, and may Yahweh take vengeance on David's enemies. Well, you know what? I'd thought for a long time that there was something strange in that covenant. I didn't really ever understand until I came over here to 2 Samuel chapter 9 why Jonathan had actually said what he said. Because twice he mentions Yahweh cutting off all the enemies from the face of the earth. Now, you can understand sort of in the context here, he's saying, if I live, you show me the loyalty, the same steadfast love as God shows David, please do that. And if I am cut off and I'm not going to die, and by the way, I actually believe Jonathan knew that he was going to be taken out of the way. He wanted to be next to David, but I think he knew he couldn't be, because of what Samuel had said. So he says here, "And if I'm not going to be, if I do die, make sure you show that same love to my family when Yahweh cuts off all your enemies, of whom," not being written, "of whom my father might be one, of whom others in my house might be another, of whom most of my tribe might be another. David, when Yahweh cuts off your enemies, I'm not one." I think that's what Jonathan was saying. And he made a covenant that day that the love of Yahweh might be seen, as they had shared that love between each other, that love of Yahweh might be seen in David, even at the point where Yahweh came and cut off his enemies, because Jonathan knew absolutely that David was going to be king, and he knew God would cut off his enemies. Well, you come over to 2 Samuel 9, David's just been smashed all his enemies all around to extend the kingdom, and he's now reigning in justice and judgment. What is the one thing that would come into your mind after finally all your enemies are at rest? Do you think David ever forgot those words? They would have been indelibly engraved in his mind. He would have thought about them time and time again, week after week, day after day, month after month, despite all the other things that happened to him. And when finally Yahweh cut off all his enemies, he said, "I don't know of anyone from Saul's house. I don't know anyone from Jonathan's house, but I want to find somebody. Go and look. Go and ask. Go out through my kingdom and look and find." And that's what this chapter's about. Prompted by finally God doing what Jonathan himself said God would do for him. And Jonathan said, "When that happens, please don't forget me and my house." Well, David's loyalty to that man was just intense. And he went out looking. And they found a man. Interestingly, they found a man. They found a man who was called Ziba, a servant here. David had didn't know that he existed, or that he knew some information, so he calls him in, as we know the story. And the king said, "Is there not yet any of the house of Saul that I may show unto him the kindness of God to him?" And Ziba said unto the king, "Jonathan hath yet a son, which is lame on his feet." Can you imagine what that did to David? Now, we just read the story about Mephibosheth, it's a Sunday school story. This is the man that had saved his life for 10 or 15 years of his life as he's been chased by this man's crazy father. He had held his hope in Yahweh. And now he finds out, after all this time, there's actually a son that he didn't know anything about. And the king said, "Where is he?" And Ziba said unto the king, "Behold, he's in the house of Machir, the son of Amniel and Lobdah." He is right on the very outskirts of your kingdom, as far away from Jerusalem as he could possibly get. We know why he was there. We know he was hiding. Then King David sent and fetched him. "Get him fast." He didn't care whether he was lame on his feet. He had to get him. And he shows the kindness of Yahweh. That Exodus 34 says, has God keeping mercy for thousands and forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin? That's the kind of mercy. It's the kind of mercy that's not deserved. It's the kind of mercy that's not earned. But it's active because God exercises it. He doesn't just talk about it. He exercises it. And he does not expect the full repayment. It's not tit for tat. God does not say, "I'll show you some mercy if you show me some." God's mercy is as wide as from east to west. Well, did David need Saul's house? Certainly not. Did Saul's house deserve any consideration? Definitely not. Yet, here in chapter 9, we're being told about a man that's truly after God's own heart. This is not just a man who had a loyal friend and is doing something just for his friend. This is a man who had a friend that was like Yahweh too. And that friend said to him, "David, I want you to always be like Yahweh. Whether I'm alive or dead, whether our friendship continues or not, don't ever stop being like God." And that's why chapter 9 is in the scriptures. It's an initiating response from a man truly after God's own heart, desiring to show the kindness of God and wanting nothing in return. It's the very spirit of Psalm 72. "He shall deliver the poor and needy, and him that hath no helper." That was David's vision of the kingdom. And here he is, exercising it. That proves he was the right man to be on the throne. But if you haven't noticed, brothers and sisters, we've got to read the scriptures really carefully. I'll have to tell you something that I've been looking at this chapter for some months and this whole section. And it wasn't until today that I actually noticed something in this chapter. And it's the use of the word king. Because mostly when David is fighting battles or doing other things, it just tells us it's just David. Look, when even he's reigning in verse 15 of chapter 8, and David reigned, doesn't say King David. When David had great victory and David, they became David's servants, they didn't become King David's servants. But the word king here is attached to both David and is used of David. I don't know. I don't know the number, but it's at least a dozen times just in this chapter. And then it all goes back in the next chapter and we don't hear of David being the king. Oh, David, of course David was the king. What's it saying? I think it's saying this was exactly what Isaiah 16 was saying. The throne was prepared in mercy and executed righteousness and judgment. You know, brothers and sisters, there's been very few kings in all of history that have ever been able to execute righteousness as judgment and balance mercy in that. In fact, there's been no other individuals ever except our Lord Jesus Christ. And his kingdom is going to come and he's going to perfectly balance all of those qualities together. Well, here's one. The man after God's own heart who is going to be, who is going to lay down the pattern for the true out here in Christ. And here he is as the king, executing mercy and compassion on a poor, wretched, lame man who was good for nothing, who couldn't work, who couldn't earn his own living, who couldn't look after himself, and someone had to do everything for him. Well, that is what David was about. He could never have walked away from that. And the king took control here. And the king said, get him. And the king said, give him this back. Give him his lands back. And make him come into my palace. And he can sit at my table. The king said all of those things. It wasn't just David. You know, when he was talking to Mephibosheth, it goes back to David. Because now David has this, he's no longer the king. He's David who's showing compassion to this young man who's 25 years his junior. You know, we can walk away from little stories like this, brothers and sisters, and say it's all very interesting. But it's got to change us. Change David. And he exercised loving kindness, righteousness, and justice. Well, all we know of Mephibosheth before this is recorded in chapter 4, verse 4 of 2 Samuel. And the only bit of information you'll get from that verse is that he was lame in his feet. We come here to verse 4 when he's introduced, and the only thing we're told is he's lame in his feet. That's the first thing we're told in this chapter about him. And then we're told where he lives and what he was doing, and we're told a few other things. And the very last thing, verse 13 says, and he was lame on both his feet. So this man comes into the divine record as one that's lame on his feet. He's pretty useless, basically. He's really got no strength to do anything. He can't look after himself. Basically, he's a lost individual. And that's how it ends. Starts and ends, like that. And we know very little in between. But David says, bring him to me. It doesn't matter how far you have to go. You've got to go 500 kilometres to get him. And he brings him back. And look at Mephibosheth. Verse 6 tells us that he fell on his face. He did reverence and recognized he was a servant. Verse 8, again, I'm thy servant. In fact, I'm only a dead dog. Everything that comes out of the mouth of this man shows his total unworthiness for anything that David was going to do to him. And when that Saul, David comes to him finally in verse 7, David says unto him, fear not. And if you were Mephibosheth, brothers and sisters, you would have been absolutely visibly shaking in front of that monarch. This was the most powerful man in the entire Middle Eastern world. He had smashed armies that no one could ever thought could have been done. And now he's quivering before him. And not only that, he's from the house of Saul that had persecuted him all the way up and down in his earlier years. And now he's got the power. He's got the power to just take his head off. And I have no doubt that Mephibosheth thought that he was finished. He was already useless. He already felt useless. And now he thought this was the end. But the king's command came, "Fear not." It's one of the most beautiful words in all of the Bible, brothers and sisters. They came from the angel to Daniel when he had no strength. When he was in a picture of our mortality, unable to do anything. And they came so freely from the words of our Lord to those who had no strength. And I think to us, they'll be the most beautiful words we ever hear if our Lord says them to us. But it's evidence of the chesed of Yahweh. And David didn't just say, "Fear not." He said, "I will show you the chesed." Amazing. "I will restore you, your inheritance. I'll elevate you to sonship. I'll bring you into my house." And Mephibosheth's thinking, "Well, what did I do? I did nothing. I didn't even know who you were. I know nothing about my father and you." He knew nothing about Jonathan and David's relationship. He was only 5 when his father died. He could never have understood. But now he came to understand. We won't go through it in any detail, but you can have a copy of that if you'd like later. But it's a beautiful parable, brothers and sisters, of our own helplessness. And before the Son of God in David here, we will feel the same. Lame from start to finish, but the recipients of the most amazing blessings and given a hope beyond anything that we could imagine we are worth. It's a beautiful little story, and it tells us an enormous amount about this wonderful man that will type the work of our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, I'm just going to beg 2 minutes to finish the story to get to where we need to be next time. I had no intention of dealing at length with what's in chapter 10, but let's summarise it. Because David even shows kindness to his enemies. Look at verse 2. David said, "I will show kindness to Hanan, the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness to me," because he'd heard that his father had died. And so in genuineness, there twice he wanted to show kindness, it tells us. Well, however, this Hanan, the son of Nahash — Nahash means a serpent, he's a true son of a serpent here — and I think he represents the seed of the serpent, manifest nationally and individually. And Nahan here misreads David's intent. You know, you'd think reading this story that this man's either a fool or just saturated with his own pride, and probably both. And quickly this situation escalates into a problem for him, and he calls in mercenaries. He pays them an enormous sum of money to come from Syria and engages in battle with David. Well, David doesn't even think that this is serious enough for him to go, and he sends Joab. And Joab brilliantly moves in and splits the mercenaries from the Ammonites and deals with both. He and Abishai take some each, and they deal with them, and they all flee, and they go back to Jerusalem. But, you know, there's a interesting insight into the influence of David in this whole period of these battles, because of even Joab's. Joab's even comes out as a looking like a spiritually minded man. He realised that God's help was actually going to be required here. But there's the typical significance of this battle here that's with the Ammonites and with the Syrians up north. You know, you can see what's going to happen when Christ comes. This is going to be typical of what happens. Christ will subdue the nations, to some of them, around the nation of Israel, to establish a capital and get his people established. But then there will be other nations that rise up and he'll need to go and attack. You know, the world isn't suddenly going to come to rest, because as Daniel 2 shows us, that there's going to be a stone that eventually grows into a mountain, and then that's going to eventually grow into all the earth. It's going to take some considerable time. There'll be twos and fros in this. And just what happened here, this nation coming and then others ganging together and rising to attack the king in Jerusalem, will be just what happens in the future, as Psalm 2 very clearly tells us, actually. But, you know, it insists on another level, and I suppose the more important level, is that all of these battles are typical of the warfare that we're fighting. And even when we sometimes think we have a victory over the flesh, by the power of God, the Spirit has overcome, the enemy can strike again, as it did here. Sometimes with momentum that it gathers from elsewhere. Sometimes with greater force than it had before. And we've got to learn to appreciate where David put his trust through all of this. And might I say, when we read the Psalms, and Psalm 9 and Psalm 21 that we don't have time to look at tonight, are a couple of Psalms that are set in this context. That when read, we can see how it applied to David, but we've got to go past that to see the strength and encouragement that we can get to put our own trust in God in the times when we are fighting our own battles. And I'd like to just finish with this, because this final battle, in chapter 10, which is quite a substantial battle, more serious in some ways than many of the other battles that David had fought, Syrians came back with a vengeance for a final showdown. Brother Harry Tennant said, "A man has many enemies and a king has more. A king establishing his kingdom in the face of opposition has a sea of troubles." And David was no exception. The events that just described indicate the strength of the forces around Israel's border. And only the blessing of the Lord could have brought the overwhelming victories which attended the march of the soldiers of the 12 tribes. But there were other enemies which war against the soul. And these enemies are within the gate, hidden forces which will arise to strike in moments of weakness and cause havoc behind the lines. What he's getting at is that all of this is written for a reason. These are not just interesting stories. This is about our warfare. That was as deadly serious as David fighting those battles for his life and for the life of his people. And set right in the middle of this particular fight against the Ammonites and the Syrians comes chapter 11, where we're going to next time. And the enemy is shown to be more serious, more sinister than all those who had come against David to this point.